February 1st, 2010. Scott Woods here, talking to Bob Dobbs. Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Well, I just want to point out that it's the day before my 88th birthday, February 2nd, and this is the best place to have my pre-birthday party with you, Scott. You old Canadian, you.
Yeah. Good to know. So, I was kind of verbalizing to you, you know, some more of my usual identity crisis kind of stuff prior to the show, and you know where am I going to take this conversation from here? Where are we going to go, et cetera, et cetera? And you know, we had a lot of interesting little detours of thought, even in the preamble, which we unfortunately didn't tape. But we thought we would let's try and go back to some of the Meltzer stuff, because what was actually your explanation for why you thought going back to the Meltzer stuff would be one way to approach it? Because you were mentioning something about, you know, we need an object or something to look at, or that's what you think works best for these conversations, or?
Yeah, Meltzer is the best because he tackles such broad areas: art, politics, power, sex, love, meaning, culture, and he's trying to have a macro view in the mid-60s into the late 60s, while dealing with his micro experiences of orgasmic fun with radio in the same time. And so, and he produces a strange way of writing, which I think is a preamble to understanding the rhythms of our time. So he's the best and the only one that we can continue looking into it, like you can't stop looking in Finnegan's Wake, because it's hard to get it all, and that's better. Anybody else just does straight prose, you get it, and then it's gone. But his work lives, and so we can come back in session 9 and go back into it, and there's a lot more stuff, and I think that it sparks me.
And it's funny because, I do keep going back to Meltzer a lot, and yet I know other people who have never been able to make it once through Aesthetics of Rock, and, you know, they're very well-read people in some ways. You know, many people have probably read a lot more literature than I have, and I've until some of your explanations of this stuff a few weeks ago or several weeks ago, I've always had kind of a really difficult time explaining back to people why I keep going back to Meltzer. And, you know, I've always been self-conscious because I think. Well, maybe they think I'm just being pretentious because, you know, it's difficult stuff. So, I want to say I kind of like the difficult stuff or whatever. But I have always kind of been drawn back to this book, and I guess it maybe is a bit of a Finnegan's Wake effect, because it's been really hard to sort of play it back.
Yeah.
That's why I appreciate these chats about it, obviously, because it you are kind of able to play it back in a way that is, you know, it's beginning to make some sense to me. The whole, in particular, the whole concept or idea about being a tactile experience, and your definition of tactility alone is not, you know, the normal definition of tactility as I've always sort of previously understood it.
Right. What's really interesting about Meltzer is that he's influenced by Alan Kaprow, who was one of the fathers of the happenings art scene, and definitely Kaprow was a McLuhanite. And so since I say that McLuhan had the key to how to keep thinking about this strange, unthinkable territory we're moving into, that there is actually a McLuhan influence on Meltzer. I can see it, though he may not recognize it, but the dialogues he had with Kaprow, he may not know how much McLuhan was in there, but they are in there, and he's thinking around Kaprow and his friend Sam Perlman. You know what I mean? Sam
right.
Perlman. So that's what I mean, that's why I can use it. It's talking McLuhan stuff. Just the phrase unknown tongue is a total McLuhan thing, because that goes back to Finney's Wake. So he's the most McLuhan-esque, whether he knows it or not.
Yeah. Well, and I think, as we've mentioned before, he does intuit it, at least, because he does mention McLuhan in a few places in his writing, but he
like Zappa, he wants to get around it, which is natural.
He wants to get around it, yeah.
Yeah. But he doesn't know that he's so not around or outside of McLuhan in what he's attempting to do contra to what he thought McLuhan was. But
yeah.
The point is that Caprao would talk about ideas that justified the happenings movement he was part of that were those theorists, those artists, they used McLuhan to support what they were doing. But they wouldn't say McLuhan, but they would talk some of the mixed media ideas that was implied by McLuhan and say those words, and that's what would be influencing Meltzer.
He would. Right, right.
He may have known Caprao, quoted McLuhan, or may not, but it's there in the dialogue, and that dialogue is happening at the beginning of the Android meme. And so that's why this lives. Meltzer lives, because he's working with the same, the correct sources, so to speak, the ones that have the most nutrition, the most long-lasting effect. I mean, people don't fully get McLuhan even now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So go to, of the excerpts from Aesthetics of Rock that I sent you, Bob, go to page 19. It's probably pretty early on.
Okay, I got that. And which part?
I'm interested in the second footnote on that page, footnote number 25, about influence. It says, influence, in quotes, contradicts, anti-historicism. Influence presupposes history. But for object expansionist Rock, history is part of the object and not particularly a ground for the significance of the object. I have a really hard time unpacking the second part of that, and you can take a stab at that. But just the idea of influence is something I've come across a lot in the last few years. There's a few critics I'm familiar with who have kind of interestingly questioned the whole relevance or value of using the word influence. It really is one of those critical buzzwords almost that is kind of used as a shortcut often, like so-and-so is influenced by so-and-so. And obviously, you know, you can get some legitimate information from using it. But I don't know, what do you think he's saying in the first part there? Influence contradicts anti-historicism.
Okay.
Influence presupposes history.
Yeah, no, this is an excellent quote. And we were talking about discussing a third object rather than ourselves, and he has the phrase part of the object right in there, so this is appropriate. So let's go up to what he's footnoting.
What he's referring to.
Yeah, so he says, to avoid the difficulty in using given terms to explain a rock phenomenon, Thomas Thompson created For Life, 1965, Life magazine.
Right.
Thompson created For Life his own equally superficial terms, namely the Detroit Motown sound, Nashville sound, New York sound, Chicago sound, West Coast sound, British sound, and Phil Spector sound. He has also contributed the finest interpretation / misinterpretation
That's great.
of the genesis of rock in an illustrated chart. In brackets, charts are always fun. Well, I like that. In an illustrated chart, charts are always fun.
Yeah, that's Bob.
Yeah. It is too bad that the article did not appear a few months later, for new absurd connections of his branches became possible, with Ramsey Lewis demonstrating Thelonious Monk's direct influence upon the mainstream of rock, and Roger Miller doing the same by influencing the Fortunes. Then he says, however, I have never understood his exclusion of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, for its impact on Jan and Dean is not too oblique, and this inclusion would have continued the influence of Thompson's religious branch. And then it goes into footnote 26. So,
Yeah. Not
knowing immediately what he might mean by influence and anti-historicism, I'll just go by what the words mean to me. So
Yeah. He
says influence presupposes history. Now, he's picking up that it's a really discontinuous environment in music. That, you know, Phil Spector is listening to someone before him. That inspires him to create something totally new. And then that inspires someone to bounce off Phil Spector. So McLuhan's idea that we live 200 years every 10, 200 years every 10, every decade, shows you the speed that's going on, and you don't have the span of time for a era or period to figure out the historical causes or what's going on before you shift to another era. And so McLuhan used to say that history was literary history, and he said history was a product of literacy and was limited to the book world, the Gutenberg galaxy, and is not relevant after 1945 because there's too much going on that you couldn't even begin to simplify it to a linear historical record. So when Meltzer says influence presupposes history, That's right. If influence means linear cause and effect, billiard ball hits another ball, you know, and then leads to other sequences like the domino theory, that is not the right, correct way to look at the phenomenon of rock. So he doesn't want to use influence, and he says it contradicts anti-historicism. Now, anti-historicism might be a technical scholarly term in the mid-60s, I don't know. But it contradicts anti-historicism. One has to be an anti-historicism or anti-limiting yourself to literary lineage if you're going to look at anything after 1945. So he's saying that he's going to look at rock without any literary bias of influence in presupposing history. So he's objecting to this guy, I think, who seems to be putting a literary chart-like interpretation on rock. And, of course, just by doing that, it's going to be misinterpretation. But probably he likes the fact that the guy is organizing, trying to organize what is everybody's experience in the early 60s. You know,
right. and it's what he himself is doing throughout his entire book.
Yeah, he's trying to visualize what's going on. So then he says, so see how influence, I mean, literary billiard ball, one thing influenced another. You know, Ernst Mach or Riemann influenced Einstein, right, back in the 19th century. So influence contradicts anti-historicism. Maybe earlier he says he's being anti-historicist. Maybe he says that in there. So he's not into what Thompson is doing. Influence presupposes history. And there's no history going on here in terms of this happened and we know these people did it. In rock, you find out a group, you have a group that happens, say the Beatles, half the people die around them, half go to jail, others leave the group and create other musics, and on it goes all over the place. You know what I mean? Where does the Beatles begin and where does it stop? And then you have the audience's fan reaction, creating fan clubs and zines and all that. It's like a huge Niagara Falls of Beatledom that you don't say, well, so-and-so met so-and-so and then they did this. Those are factors, but they're nowhere near the whole experience. Okay, so he says, but for object expansionist rock, let's say that he means by that is that rock is huge. Any phenomenon is huge, so it expands the object, which is what McLuhan says, is that teen music, he said 50 or more years ago, is not music, it's an environment. So the whole other media that involved with the Beatle fad, that is larger than the music, and therefore the object of the Beatles has expanded.
Right, okay.
Right, so for rock is multimedia, not limited just to music or the lyrics, so it is an object expansionist situation. So I would, it's endlessly proliferating into unforeseen other spin-offs. So yeah. That's, I take that to mean that. But for object expansion rock, history is part of the object. Very good. You know, we have, if pop music is the tactile electric experience, that involves all the senses. The eye, the visual sense, is part of it. So to write charts is, like my chart, a little throwaway as part of the whole dialogue. It's not something that you force everybody to study, except I do my chart because it's a very good chart. But anyways, it's also aware of itself as just being a linear layout, my chart.
Right.
So,
right.
But it is, we, especially the Westerners, we got the eye. We're addicted to the eye. We want to see a chart. We want to see a book on this, all right? So history is part of the object. It's not the whole, what do they say in postmodernism? It's not the totalist. It's not...
Totality.
Yeah, it's not the totalism, the totality of the explanation. So history is part of the object and not particularly a ground for the significance of the object. Perfect! Oh, you're using the McLuhan word ground.
You've been using ground, yeah.
And McLuhan started talking about figure ground in the late 60s. Unless...
I was going to say, that came later, didn't it?
Yeah, it was more known in the late 60s, early 70s. Like maybe Take Today, he talks about figure ground. Okay, and this book, he could have written this in 68, 69, 70, but pretty well he's not going to be using it by getting it from McLuhan, I'm pretty sure, unless he read some obscure interview that Alan Kaprow gave him or something. But anyways, you can see Kaprow and them might have been using the word in general terms. And he may not mean it the way we do or the way McLuhan does. Ground is the actual general medium that's happening in the society. And the main medium in the mid-60s is the satellite environment, all right, and the beginning of the computer world. So that's the ground. But he's saying history is part of the object and not a ground for the significance of the object. Perfect sentence. But that, he's saying that it's a figure ground situation, and the ground cannot be literary history or the billiard ball connection domino theory. It is part of it, but you must include all the other multimedia forms of experiencing the Beatles. Right? And what is the significance of the Beatles? And the significance becomes beyond the rock industry. I mean, the Beatles are communicating to everybody, and everybody is involved. They're not reacting that way to a Smokey Robinson song or the Smokey Robinson phenomenon. But that becomes lumped into the Motown thing. So the actual object is the city and the industrial recording studio scene that is producing all this content. And so the guy's chart is accurate to say there's the Detroit, it's not music, but there's the Detroit sound, the Nashville sound. You might have not even used the word sound. It's the New York multimedia, Chicago multimedia, because they all go on to get on Ed Sullivan, West Coast multimedia, British multimedia, Phil Spector multimedia. See that? Okay, so with that in mind, I'm going to back and read this, see if that's what he's getting at. To avoid the difficulty in using given terms to explain a rock phenomenon, so he's saying that it's pretty hard to explain something in historical or influence or limited visual terms, literary terms. To avoid that, Thompson created for life his own equally superficial terms, and McLuhan said that his terms, hot and cool, were superficial, cliche archetype. Any dialectic is superficial because it's just verbal stuff, and it's just a quick do-it-yourself kit thing to grasp this larger post-verbal, paraverbal situation. So his own equally superficial terms, granted, no problem with that, namely the environments, but these terms are accurate, what they're referring to. He has also contributed the finest interpretation, misinterpretation of the genesis of rock in an illustrated chart. Charts are always fun. So we'd have to see what that chart is, and I bet you both Meltzer and Thompson missed the fact that rock came out of the radio environment itself, affecting movies and automobiles and all the environments of the industrial towns of the 30s and 40s and 50s. See, I bet you they don't say that is the ground. They're probably figuring out, you know, some guy, some rock musician or early blues guy in the 40s and how that influenced Liberace, who influenced Elvis or something like that. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that is, Your misinterpretation, if you are trying to connect the influences, the chain of influence, based on human beings' chemical bodies, that's not really the big influence. The big influence is radio as an experience itself. You see, that's what McLuhan was pointing out.
Right.
And so.
What about the other technologies? I think anyone would agree were crucial.
The electrification of the sound?
Yeah, exactly. Like electric guitars, microphones.
Yeah, that's microphones.
That's created. Radio, right? Microphone.
That's radio and microphone, and radio and then the microphone created the Nazi Germany. All right? Which was the first. David Bowie said in Playboy in about 1976, I remember this interview, he said he regarded Hitler as the first pop star.
Right, I've read that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's not a bad point, but that's a figure. Why is he the first pop star? Well, popism comes in with the fact you're living, say, 100 years every decade in the radio turnover from 1922 to World War II. You get all those blues musicians, all those records, and then all the swing bands, all this stuff. Each person is a pop phenomenon for a short time, right?
Yeah.
And then it becomes politicized. And Hitler comes on and uses the new media to rant on stuff that's not within the literate decency of traditional propaganda. It's just thuggery and just stirring up the tribal emotions. Different. It's like a rock and roll concert, you know, like Nuremberg, the famous movies. So what we mean by pop is electrified. So Hitler was the first electrifying politician.
So what does that make, this is getting off base, but what is that, or off topic, but what does that make, what do you say about FDR in comparison with Hitler? Because he used the radio medium.
Yeah, he was the first electrifying politician in America. What's really interesting and useful is the way McLuhan looked at these different radio icons, you know, Churchill, Roosevelt, Hitler, Stalin, and there might be someone else in there. Maybe Eva. What's that woman in
Eva Perón?
Yeah, but that's in the 40s.
Evita Perón.
Yeah, but that's a little later, but it's still...
That's later, though, yeah.
But they're just getting radio, you know what I mean? So
right.
They're getting radio later, so to speak. Okay, so he said that the British and the Americans, being literate and industrial, were not able to respond with the group mind, because it was individualist and fragmented, to the radio tribalism, to the radio tribal drum, as much as the less industrialized Japanese, Russians, and Germans, because radio retrieved their tribal emotions because they weren't as fragmented and individualized via the literate medium that Britain and France were. I mean, Britain and the United States. So then McLuhan said, that's why in the early 30s, Japan and Hitler felt superior to the anemic British and Americans, because they felt the power of their tribal population and were able to ride on the confidence of that for 5 or 6 years. And the British and the Americans were playing catch-up. But you look at Roosevelt knew that radio was important, but he did fireside chats, decent literary verbal conversations. He didn't rant on about, like Hitler did, right?
Right, yeah.
But it was very charismatic for illiterate people to have someone speak to them. He spoke in proper Americanese, literary Americanese. We don't mean by literary that they were great novelists, just living in the industrial, fragmented, literate newspaper world. So,
right.
So you can see the low-key politicians of Britain and the United States compared to Hitler. So that's how you look at this. And so here's, and part of the radio caused Hitler to overreact, because the music that came out of America, jazz, became the global Esperanto, unified cultures all over the world. And Louis Armstrong and these guys are playing in Europe in the 20s and 30s. And just like France hates Disneyland and McDonald's today, the Germans, for all kinds of complex reasons, including the humiliation of losing World War One, so they're already feeling less than and inferior. But anyways, they've got this invasion of this alien culture and rhythm coming in on the radio environment. That's going to make them tribally paranoid. So radio actually caused the whole complex of anemic literary reaction, tribal reaction, and then led to war. So music is a subset of that. The jazz world, you know what I mean, is a subset of the effect of radio. That's the ground. That's how you find the significance of jazz in the ground, so the significance of the object jazz in the ground of radio.
Okay.
And then you look at what they had the Copenhagen Conference in physics. Quantum physics starts coming in. They're trying to visualize what can't be visualized. So they're responding to the non-visual landscape that radio brought in. So you go across the whole culture. So here's Meltzer's dilemma is, if he had read McLuhan, he would go beyond rock criticism and he would look at physics and all the different phenomena that's part of the ground. And so why is Einstein significant and someone else isn't? Because his ideas resonated with the new radio effect. But because he's just a young person, loves music, he's going to try to put everything of this new figure ground analysis into music. But he's aware that he can't limit it to the music. And that's basically what he's writing around, that dilemma.
Right.
You know what I mean? He was forced to specialize in his appreciation of rock, and he also had the misfortune of being the first to do it, almost, and therefore he stuck with the cross to carry, right? Because he started it. He started on a deeper level than most people were doing, if they were doing anything. So, okay, so we get to, but for object, okay, so he's saying, see, but he always has to go both ways. We can't use history, that's literary, and that's not really going to deal with the new electric environment. But we have to include it.
Right.
But we include it as part of an inventory of other things, which would be the other senses.
Right. And when he says, and not particularly a ground for the significance, do you sense from what you know of Meltzer in this book that he understands the ground, or are you saying he doesn't?
Well, I haven't read his book in 30 years, and I've only read bits of what you sent, so I just assume he doesn't get McLuhan's point because of the way he remarks on McLuhan. He's just
right.
way off, you know, and just like he did in his interview with you, you know, about Burroughs and McLuhan, you know, ridiculous. So, but I can understand that he is influenced by McLuhan through Alan Kaprow and his professors and the culture he was in at university, at Yale.
Yeah.
Okay, so he goes, but for object expansion is rock, history is part of the object, and not a ground for the significance of the object, and not particularly. See, particularly is, again, pointing to a little specialist eye phenomenon, you know, using the eye. The eye picks out little details. And not a ground, not particularly. He can't even say that. See, so he's
right.
being tactile. He's shifting back and forth among the five senses constantly.
That's amazing.
And that's why you can't, which is exactly what Finney's Wake does, that's why if you're looking for the point Finney's Wake is making, or its attitude, or its position, point of view, it ain't going to work, because Joyce is showing you the process of tactile perception you're going through, because the electrical environment enhances that. And that's exactly what Melter is sort of intuiting.
Okay.
That's why, you know, he says not, and then he has to say not, or he has to say Thompson has a fine interpretation / misinterpretation. That is the correct way to talk about this. You always cancel what your printed word is pointing to, because that limits it, makes it too particular.
And is that one reason why criticism is can be inadequate when it's tied solely to value judgments?
Yes, and to one object, to one thing. Do you like the new song by so-and-so?
Right.
And, you know, who's hearing the song? What's going on in the culture at the time? Did suddenly, you know, what's that famous guy in Austin, Texas? It was one of the first snipers, August 66. He starts sniping from the University of Texas campus from a tower and, you know, killing people. That was the first in public terrorism, one of the first in American culture. That becomes a big issue. What's going on there? So what song resonated with that news event right at that point, accidentally? You know what I mean?
Right, okay.
I think of, in my diaries in Andor Means Anachrony, I talk about the week that Kennedy is assassinated. I think it's the song Crying. I can't remember who did it. And it totally fits the mood that America's feeling that weekend. And it becomes a big hit that week. But if the Kennedy assassination had not happened, that song would not have been noticed.
Yeah. It's funny, I often, when I'm thinking of a large world-scale event or something, I actually turn to my Billboard collection to see what was number one that week.
No, that's the way to do it. I do that myself. I have one of those record lists from Chum in Toronto. They
right, hit, the Chum chart book or whatever.
Yeah, you got one of those?
Yeah.
Okay. It reminds me of the little dialogue in Lumpy Gravy by Zappa, where one guy, you did that too? Yeah, I did. They start laughing because they both match on that point. You did that too?
I thought I was the only one, yeah.
Yeah. So the, like, take this new phenomenon, pants on the ground.
Right.
Somebody told me that they were shocked. That pants, the guy who did pants on the ground, which was, look at this, talk about mixed corporate media interruption, half amateurism, and this guy did an audition, didn't even get picked, but he becomes the biggest phenomenon because of his audition. Do you know about it, pants on the ground?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he got to walk or do the carpet at the Grammys last night. Somebody was shocked that he was, yeah, my friend James, I do cash flow, he said, did you see that guy? He made the Grammys.
that's been a bit of a trend on American Idol. The you know, the little bits I've watched of it over the years, and you know, I always kind of keep a little bit of tabs on it. I think only one season I actually kind of watched it, you know, to see who would actually win. But the it's often these little side, it's the side shows.
Yep.
That often end up being the main event in the public imagination. Like there was that other guy a few years ago, this. You know, just this kind of totally crazy, I don't know, like, I think he might have been East Indian kid or something. Sanjay, I think, was his name.
Yeah.
And like, you know, crazy mohawk and stuff. He was the person who was talked about by far the most throughout the entire season, and even after he was booted off.
Okay.
So, like, it's the sideshow effect is more, like, talk a bit about that. I don't know. Is that like the white elephant kind of syndrome?
No. It's the tactile. The tactile is not any particular thing. It's the whole ecology, the whole field. And so you have industrial big brother centralism, what Orwell calls 1984, coming in the 30s. And then by the 50s and 60s, the electric effect of television and computers and satellites decentralizes the culture. So the culture is oscillating between centralist images and decentralist. And that tension is constant. So, for example, today, or maybe 10 years ago, why did Harry Potter books become popular? Because they offered a centralized image for the eye during the time of the Internet when everybody, the eye was getting fragmented into everybody's little computer matrix tube. Okay, so you have people, they understand as you go away from the center, and then you come back to the center. And then you go back and forth, so you're always juggling it. And then you have different parts of the population doing the centralist or the decentralist or different age groups all at the same time. And so when you have the American Idol, that's so late, that's a holopathic replay of a replay of the fame thing that's been going on for most of the 20th century.
Right.
So you centralize on a champion, but people are bored with the champion, the centralist effect. So what is the decentralist parallel operation that goes with this? The sidebars, the side digressions.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Both are spiraling at the same time. What did Zappa do? He did that song, Eccentrifugal Force, I think it was. Eccentrifugal, very good. You could say centrifugal is moving away from the center. That was the trend in the 60s because of the satellite decentralization, all the counterculture and all that. The 70s was considered by Lester Bangs as the bland-out generation and the bland-out decade because it moved back to a centralist motif. And Zappa is saying that, eccentrifugal force. I think it's spelled F-O-R-Z. And so the 70s, he does that song in 73, 74, I think it's on apostrophe. He's pointing out that where the fragmentation that was happening in the 60s has been balanced off by tendencies towards centralization, where all the students went back to university in the youth culture. Because they actually realized the revolution wasn't going to work after Kent State, and then people are actually going to shoot you. So, and Vietnam was winding down, so people sort of went bland. And then there's that natural tension because America's built on a centralist bureaucracy. You're going to keep that meme going, but you can't hold it. You know, Yeats's line, the center cannot hold. What rough beast slouches toward Jerusalem? Well, that's always worked out in people. How much are you going to let it ride and decentralize and fragment? How much are you going to allow your family to be not have dinner together at the same time you want to maintain the icon of the family? That's just a technical problem, you know, in 30 years ago. So that's my point is you're going to... Because the media need conversation. Okay, so you focus on the winner. What's her name, Jennifer Hudson? She won.
Yeah.
I saw her. She was at the Grammys or something.
She was a runner-up one year, I think, and then she ended up being in a movie or something.
Yeah, Dreamgirls, and then she becomes famous
yeah.
for that. Well, I saw her in some image in the news the other day. She was doing something at the party before. Somebody screwed up. Mary J. Blige screwed up at the party, the pre-party.
Okay.
Because she chewed out her band right in front of everybody, but they had pictures of people there. So you have the focus on her, but she's just a bland person. You can't talk about her for an hour, so you got to talk about all the side things. And then
yeah.
you hope some bizarre thing like Pants on the Ground happens to fill in the time. Because remember, you're ultimately just providing content for the
right.
big the televisual industrial vacuum cleaner. That cleans up the vacuum. You got to provide content. So that's always going. So the object, it's just incredible how accurate Meltzer's writing, from my point of view, but he might not even agree with my interpretation of his own words. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No,
but the words are there, and we have the right to interpret them the way we want to on the centrifugal level. We don't have the right to carry that centrifugal personalized meaning interpretation all the way, because we are trying to standardize things here by writing a book, which is a centripetal force. It's moving back to a hierarchy, a visual hierarchy about what is the correct meaning. So look at the next thing. He said, it is too bad that the article did not appear a few months later, for new absurd connections of his branches became possible, with Ramsey Lewis demonstrating Thelonious Monk's direct influence upon the mainstream of rock, and Roger Mill doing the same by influence of Fortune. See, in other words, you make a probe like a chart. You can't say whether it's right or wrong because so many things are going to pop up in the in the centripetal and centrifugal dialectic that all of a sudden something's relevant. You know, like because a new phenomenon comes up because the media needs content. So Ramsey Lewis demonstrates Monk's influence. Or the Fortunes do well and Miller somehow influenced them. So that's why when Joyce wrote Finney's Wake, he tried to put the whole book on each page. Because all the elements that he was juggling in the book were relevant at different times, and he never knew when.
Wait, say that again, Bob?
Joyce tried to put the whole book in Finney's Wake on each page.
Yeah.
Because he knew that something could be retrieved as he worked out the ostensible history line, the story, the novel, the plot. Something could suddenly show up because something happens in his radio environment. Hitler shows up. In 1933, and he started writing The Wake in 1922, so he changes The Wake in that mid-30s because of all that's happening. And maybe he has to emphasize one part of The Wake that was on the first page that wasn't so relevant at that point, but now in the 30s is. So you put it all in, temporary hoik up an object, but the object is not the whole phenomenon. It's the figure ground process that's going on.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. So let's look at his footnote. He says, however, I've never understood his exclusion of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, as if the guy would even know it, but anyways, for its he knows it, but I bet you this guy doesn't know that the Mormon Tabernacle Choir influenced Jan and Dean.
Or I think what Meltzer's maybe saying there is, or maybe he's not saying, but I don't think the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, you know, outside of Meltzer, would have been allowed into the conversation about rock at that time.
Right.
I think it's really interesting. Like, Mormon Tabernacle Choir, I mean, that'd be like the squarest of the square, right? But he's already sort of hearing...
He's not worrying about
really
that.
It's fascinating that he's hearing it in Jan and Dean, and it's like, yeah, maybe, you know, that. Why not?
Yeah, maybe they were Mormons. I don't know if Jan and Dean were Mormons, you know? But the point is that he's like a TV camera scanning everything more than just writing an article. So he can notice connections, and the article inspired him to make that connection. So the article, even though it's a misinterpretation, it did make him say this sentence.
Right.
And he makes a point, because he's saying, I'm noticing it, and the guy, the Life magazine guy, didn't notice it. I did. Hey, point for me, right?
Yeah.
So then let's look at the footnote. He goes, as if I have never understood. You know, I mean, that's ridiculous. Has he been pondering this for weeks? Think of all the things. I have never understood why Scott missed the Christmas break. I just don't understand how he missed their Christmas show. You know what I mean?
I think he's taking the piss a little bit by saying that almost. Though.
Well, that's the put-on aspect.
Yeah. Like, I've never understood his exclusion of the Mormon Tabernacle.
Yeah, I've never understood that.
That's funny.
He's actually,
like... Like, if he was saying the Beatles or something, then it wouldn't be funny. You'd be taking him seriously. But
right, and he's stoned, and he suddenly gets that little humorous glint, and I'll write this, because that's easy.
Yeah, like, how dare he not bring it into Mormon?
Yeah, he was looking, he's reading some paper by Alan Kaprow, where Kaprow says, I've never understood why Picasso didn't screw Brack, you know, George Brack or something. And he's saying, how silly is thing to think about? Well, I'm going to use that. I'm going to claim I never understood, you know.
Yeah.
Under the popular most of you adapts it. So he says, for its impact on Jan and Dean is not too oblique, and
I
this
like
inclusion
that.
Would have continued the influence of Thompson's religious branch. Now, the exciting thing is we don't know what the heck's going to be said in footnote 26, so let's see where he takes us, because it's going to be weird. He goes, also, lots of real influence by pop Protestant music. Now, that's Bessel Goodman, the gospel thing I've been sending out last week.
Right.
Lots of real.
And I like this footnote a lot. Actually, read it. I've read it many times.
Many times. You've never understood why Meltzer did footnote 26. You imagine you have a job interview, and maybe your job is to be in touch with the public, and you're supposed to express awareness of the public's concerns. So they say, well, what do you consider about? Well, I've never understood why Meltzer on page 19 talked about Protestant music. I've never understood that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Used it.
Yeah, you put it in your resume. Yeah. Also, the humor here is that we are involved with so many things in our, quote, busy lives that actually you are thinking about what you process in the car when you're driving to the job interview, and then they got to be a job interview person, but you're actually thinking about what the DJ said in the car as you left to go to the interview.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Now, 100 years ago, nobody was processing what's coming over the air when they go to the farm to beat up the cow or something. You know what I mean? We have so many, which I call bodies, happening in us.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm actually cognizant of that in the respect, I mean, I'm often cognizant of it, but in the respect that it will cause a little bit of an identity crisis sometimes in me, because I'll be thinking, like, fuck, don't get diverted by this song or something right now. I'm supposed to be thinking of this or something.
Yeah.
I literally will go through that, and it's like, oh, well, whatever. It's like, you know, it's there now. It's too late kind of thing.
Right, and I think that's why a lot of people are irritable and why they got to take whatever those antidepressants are. They needed to focus. Like, I wish I could just sit and enjoy this song for 20 minutes. Nah, I got to go back to work. I got to do this or that. You know, I got to go back to my chemical body. And that so many conflicting desires going on all the time that you'll become an irritable person.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'll be too irritable, so then you got to take some antidepressant to calm you down or some Quaalude.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, Okosei says, also, lots of real influence. Oh, there he's using that word influence, by pop Protestant music on some phases of rock and rhythm and blues, as well as some direct appropriation. What the heck is this? Okay, just direct appropriation. How about the Brown Three Bells? I remember that song. You ever heard Three Bells?
Yeah, I like that song, actually.
1960, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about the Browns and Three Bells and that kind of stuff? No, what's that kind of stuff? I don't know. I guess there's other songs like that.
Or, yeah, I guess it's like the white sort of Protestant goody-goody kind of sound.
But to go, or the, see, you could
but
not.
Yeah, it's vague. It's vague. Though.
But it's oral. You see, he's speaking. You could not write that kind of stuff in a master's thesis, right? But you can because he's just miming his chatter in a coffee shop with another person about what they're just hearing on the jukebox, you know?
Well, and since you mention it, I mean, it's amazing, like, how few rock critics, particularly, like, in the first, like, 20, 30 years of the form existing, spoke that way. That's why I guess most, you know, when most critics, when they're reviewing Richard Meltzer, writing about Richard Meltzer, they often comment on the fact that the idea that he's, he writes, you know, they say he writes in the spirit of rock itself.
Yeah, he's not being visual or literary.
He's miming the rhythms, I guess.
Yeah, the rhythms and the tactile experience. They would say he's miming the rhythms or the oral or the acoustic, not noticing what I'm adding to this, the tactile fact is what he's really miming, not just the acoustic. He's miming the whole tactile interplay of all the environments. You get that?
Okay.
You get what I'm saying?
Yep.
But because he's including the rapid fan talk or enthusiasm, he can get away with saying that kind of stuff, because actually it's better to say that, because there's so much in the environment that you actually think, yeah, there's probably a whole bunch of other songs like styles like Three Bells, so it is a genre, it's a kind of a stuff, you know, as a certain
and he's just, but at the same time he's kind of tossing it out there a little bit,
yeah,
like, you know what I'm talking about, that kind of, there's no need to waste too much time on it now.
He's always oscillating between trying. And okay, back to your point about these guys for 20 years are writing because they're trying to write. They're trying to be writers, and they don't know writing doesn't deal with dancing architecture called pop music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he's always oscillating, being very tactile. I'm writing, but I'm not going to limit myself to the literary view of the object. I'm going to include the acoustic and unconsciously the tactile and constantly mime that. That's why it's better than anybody else. It's more involved.
Right, and Bangs is the other early critic who did that too.
Yeah.
You were listening to him while you read him.
Yeah, I'm not sure had Bangs read Meltzer in 65.
Oh yeah, they have a. I mean, I have to send you some more chapters from A Horror Like the Rest, Meltzer's anthology, because he has an entire section on his relationship with Bangs, like different stuff he had written about Bangs over the years.
Hey, you got a job. You got a job. Buy me the book and send it to me.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I'll photocopy it while I'm at my job. How about that?
Yeah, yeah, the photocopy is just as good. But the your point you're making there, when does Bang start reading Meltzer? Is he into Meltzer like 66, 67, really early?
I wouldn't be at all surprised if he was, because Meltzer was writing for Crawdaddy.
Right.
Crawdaddy started before Rolling Stone. Crawdaddy, the first issue, came out in 1966.
Yeah, I know the magazine.
I don't know if Meltzer was right in the first issue, but he was there pretty much very early on, if not from the very first issue. And I think most people, like, didn't have a clue. Well, even Grill Marcus mentions in the introduction to Aesthetics of Rock that he, and I think most other readers, just assumed Meltzer was joke. Like, it was just
a joke.
Yeah. But I think, I'm sure Bangs would have been well familiar with him by the time the book came out. And I think, you know, they definitely had a relationship, and I think, you know, Bangs was much more vocal about being a big fan of Meltzer than the other way around. Meltzer was a Bangs fan, but he was also very critical of him. But Bangs, I think, is even quoted as saying, like, just read Richard Meltzer. If you want to get it, read Richard Meltzer.
Oh, okay.
I think there's a quote to that effect.
Okay, so Meltzer, Bangs would have been reading Crawdaddy when it first came out.
Oh, I believe. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to believe he wasn't reading it. I mean, it maybe didn't have as good distribution as Rolling Stone, mind you, and Bangs lived in
San Diego.
Like somewhere near San Diego, El Cajon, or however you pronounce it. But.
Well, the first time I read Bangs, you know where it was?
Where?
It was 69 or 70. It was written there, and my friend Steve gave me a copy. Who put the bump?
Oh, yeah, Greg Shaw.
Yeah.
And Greg Shaw's magazine.
Yeah, that was
that his Trog's piece, probably, right?
Yeah, yeah. I remember Steve says, you got to read this, and that was my first acquaintance with Bangs. And I visited Greg Shaw's place around 1976, 77, when I was in L.A. one point. And,
really?
Yeah, went out to his warehouse where they had all, they were selling records or something. They were like
He had a label, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, early version of Rhino Records or something, right?
That's right. He's like a power pop sort of label, like sort of tied in a little bit with the new wave scene, but not fully of the new wave scene, kind of a retro sort of aspect to it as well.
Right, so I'd walk in with the new formula to understand everything, you know, and nobody cared, which I expected, but so I never connected with them. I mean, I just checked it out, saw it, would look at who put the bump, it became a little slicker by that time, and check it out, but they were all failing from my point of view of how to really make this revolution work. So, but I kept that to myself.
Greg Shaw died like 5 or 6 years ago, I think.
Did he?
Years ago. Yeah, we did a big sort of feature on him in rockcritics.com when he died, yeah.
Well, here's another funny thing, is that I didn't make an effort to follow his career, but I kept bumping into it. The guy who started Crawdaddy, Paul somebody?
Paul Williams, yeah.
Yeah, and I always bumped into him, and he... I don't know, somebody sent me an obscure magazine literary thing in the early 80s, and he was running it or writing for it. But, you know, it's interesting where he became, he sort of in the 80s just put out this fanatical Dylan newsletter or something.
He did a lot of sort of very odd things, actually. Yeah, he's written a lot about Dylan. He got very much into, I would almost want to, you know, if I had to stick a label on it, it was almost like a new agey.
Yeah,
I think kind of a very early new ager sort of thing.
And hippie.
He took a lot of flack from rock critics for that, and I get the feeling some of the writing was actually kind of bad. But
yeah, no, here's the way it is. He went into a hippie commune or something like that.
Yeah, that's what it was. He did. He literally retreated to a hippie commune.
So he and Meltzer both split the scene at the same time, and Meltzer stayed in the city, and Paul went to the country.
And I've got a piece by Meltzer. I went on eBay about a year and a half ago, and I just thought, I'll look up Richard Meltzer, see if anyone's got anything for sale. Someone was selling virtually a scrapbook full of material of Meltzer articles. It ended up being a bit of a ripoff because they're all photocopied, whatever. But I bought the thing, and there's a piece in there, and it's Meltzer, and he's lacing into Paul Williams quite viciously. Like, I think it's one of his kind of new agey books from the 80s or something. And Meltzer is almost like, he's writing about it with such disgust almost. Like, this guy is like, You know,
I know. And
he's like he's one of the pod. He's almost like he's one of the pod people or something.
That's
like
right.
Almost the tenor of his piece.
Right, and both of them didn't understand what was really going on. That's why I would not take sides in the situation. I'd explain both of them their flaws and their services in the situation. But Meltzer, like in the Crossfire 80 style, he just wanted to find someone to yell at, you know? So he, from his point of view, Paul was a easy target, but that's not for the whole population. Other people would admire Paul and for demographic reasons and not like Meltzer. So it's the ecology and interrelationships important. Now, what's really fun about having these dialogues with you is that those people that have listened to me for years didn't know that I was interested in going around and seeing Greg Shaw, you know? Mike Dyer on CKLN never brought that out of me, even though he was a music connoisseur. He didn't bring that, but I could have gone into it. And, so that's what's fun about you bring up all this part of my life that nobody knows about. Not that it's important to anybody, but it's important to my fans that they find out about this part of me.
Well, no, and it's great stuff for me too. I mean, we've got a big Paul Williams interview up on rockcritics.com and stuff too. It's quite interesting. He's actually very ill at the moment, actually.
Is that right?
There's even I contributed a little bit of money. There's like a you know, Paul Williams like needs some donations kind of thing. I mean, a destitute former rock critic, basically, you know, and I think his wife, who's involved in the music industry, I believe, as in some capacity, you know, just basically was kind of looking for some donations to help the guy out because he's probably got no health care or anything like that. So I don't know much about it, though. I don't want to say what the details are. I don't know if it's cancer or what he's got, but yeah, he's got some life-threatening illness, which I think I've known of for a little less than a year now, maybe.
Yeah, the I had an idea there. Something don't know. It might come back.
Something about the destitution of rock critics.
Yeah, the did you hear about the Thule Kupferberg benefit they did last week on January 22nd?
Yeah, I saw a little thing about. Well, I saw it on Five Bodied.
Oh yeah. Well, that's right. I sent the review, and then Bob Fass is the show that Scott just taped for me. I haven't heard it all, but I think he says he's going to talk about that later in the show. It's a 3.5-hour show, so I haven't heard it, but that's on the 29th, the week after. But there's a guy destitute who pretty well can't afford to live with his blindness that he's gotten, and he was born he's just 2 years younger than me, like about 86 now, born in 1924, 25.
He's that old, eh?
Oh, yeah, he was in his 40s, and, you know, let's see, he'd be about 41 when he started with the Fugs.
When he's in the Fugs, holy cow.
Oh, yeah, he's a whole phenomenon in New York bohemia. I used to go along Spring Street and Prince Street in the Soho and see him. He'd be there at a little table and selling his little poetry books and had some woman with him. And I gave him Bob's Meat Ecology, and we talked about it, you know, other times I saw him. Yeah, he was a fixture in the village and just still the half destitute. And he had a cable show with a bunch of anarchists, which was pretty neat. But he's incredibly creative, just a doodler, a great creative doodler, and off-the-cuff, you know, limericks and poems and jokes and that. He's pretty pretty interesting, pretty powerful creative force in the obsolete medium of being creative.
Right.
And therefore destitute, you know?
Yeah.
His chemical body creativity is obsolete, you know?
Okay.
That
makes sense.
Right.
Based
okay.
What you're saying.
Yeah, so he says, how about the Brown Street Bells and that kind of stuff, or Wink Martindale's A Deck of Cards? So he's saying you can have direct appropriation or be influenced by this pop Protestant music. Okay. Obviously, some of the weakest gospel singing comes from non-sarcastic imitation of traditional, respectable white church music. This is okay. I don't even know what this. I'm just reading the whole sentence. I don't even know what it means.
Good.
And at least in rock, weakness is a groove.
I love that. Weakness is a groove. It's a quotable line.
Yeah, and then he goes, and there's Jew stuff too. With Dance Everyone Dance, Having the Gila by Betty Somebody, which is totally appropriate because, you know, you've just heard it. How do you remember? Joyce does that in Finnegan's Wake all the time. You'll name somebody who wore the gray hat. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because you just saw him on the subway, you know? And don't forget the bird's master move. Master move! See, that's our... There's no master move. It's all quantum fluctuations of nothing, right?
Yeah.
Master move from February 66 to March 66. Obsolesced by Monterey, you know, a year later. Don't forget the bird's master move into self-generating piety and generalized, diffusely distinct sectarian, non-sectarian religiosity. Constantly tactile, constantly canceling, which I've done before, said that before, but if you didn't hear the previous sessions one and two, that's what we mean. I'm just going to finish the paragraph and we'll go back to it. What's he say? And, of course, the cow sills are the wholesomely disguised familiar general religiosity. See, just making up categories as he thinks of the pattern, you know?
Yeah.
It's just off the cuff. He's like a DJ making up stuff on the radio.
It is, totally.
And, of course, the cow sills are the wholesomely disguised familiar general religiosity moves to fuse with strong as weak as hell. Religious music arrangements after the fact, and even some Jan and Dean, Indian Lake. No, that's pretty neat. Okay, how do we, obviously some of the weakest. Okay, so he says the word weak, and he knows it's weak within singing, but in the electric environment where all genres only have a lifespan of 2 weeks or something, and then they're recycled, that it's okay that weak music can cry, actually, like that's like a Roger Miller song or the Singing Nuns or something. This weak music actually gets popular for a few weeks because it's a respite by all the other hectic Rolling Stones, Beatles, British Invasion stuff. You see, there's a fixed ground thing going on, and so weakness can be a groove in the radio medium, but not regular gospel singing, which is in the boring literate church. You see. Obviously, some of the weakest gospel singing, especially Protestant, but not the Vestal Goodman style, but, you know, Protestant churches are pretty dull music, right? Ben talks about that in the last thing we did with Ben Watson about how hateful the music was.
He says the sort of thing that turns you off of going to church and listening to gospel music.
Yeah. And then he finds Vestal Goodman, you know, powerful. Obviously, some of the weakest gospel singing comes from non-sarcastic. Now, that's interesting. Imitation of traditional, respectable... Okay, so you got traditional, respectable white church music is dull, dirge, Protestant music.
Yeah.
And then you can have a sarcastic, a non-sarcastic... Right, so gospel singing is sincere, and it's building, and it's an American upscaling of the British dirge, okay? So the weakest gospel singing... So that's it's weak because it's non-sarcastic. So do blacks do sarcastic gospel singing?
No, that sounds odd.
Yeah, but they...
I would never... Gospel music would be one form of music. I don't think sarcasm...
Well, okay, you know what he might mean? He is seeing that he's saying that the Browns and Wink Martindale is sarcastic. Is sarcastic because it's not in church, so it's in the radio medium, but... Obviously,
Right. Yeah, it's on the radio. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So some of the weakest gospel singing, that means in the church and on the radio, comes from non-sarcastic. But you get sarcastic because you know if you're the Bells, you're going to put this gospel thing on the radio for teens. You're already going to have a detached view of it and wonder if it's going to take. Right.
Right.
Okay. So obviously, some of the weakest gospel singing comes from non-sarcastic imitation of traditional, respectful white church music. That makes sense. And at least in and weakness is a groove. Yeah. See, it becomes
at least. In rock.
Yeah, it, when it gets on the radio, weakness is okay. And that's why Three Bells becomes a hit. It's weak, but it's sarcastic. unconsciously. And then he goes, there's Jew stuff, meaning stuff that comes from Jewish religion music, I guess, right?
Right, Habanagila, yeah.
And there's Jew stuff, too, with Dance Everyone Dance, Habanagila, which I don't know if that's even matchable, but he's thinking that it's matchable. No one else, I don't know if anybody, do you know the song, Dance Everyone Dance?
Well, no, but I mean, I assume with the Habanagila in brackets, it's something to do with Habanagila. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know whether they do match. I mean, would a Jewish...
variation on that or something.
Yeah, we don't know whether a Jewish person would agree with would hear Habanagila in Dance Everyone Dance, which is another example. This is just quantum particles. It just comes and goes, and even pointing out anything pattern about it is silly, but he's writing, and he's thinking of it, and he can't remember who did it, And a Jewish person may not agree that it's like having a gila, but he hears it, and that's good enough, because he's just masturbating. You know, he's just pumping up pattern recognition that he wants to do.
Yeah.
Whether it's science, art, or politics, doesn't matter. And then he goes, and don't forget the birds' master move into self-generating piety and generalized diffusely distinct sectarian or sectarian. Oh, that makes sense. Think of what do the birds do? To everything there is a season, right?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so that's a nice, serious, platitudinous song, and has piety. So master move into self-generating piety, that somehow would be piety in the radio. You don't generate piety in the self-generate piety in the church because it's already there and you don't even generate it. But when you go on a radio, you self-generate, you create radio piety. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So they self-generate piety and generalize diffusely distinct. Diffusely is like a centrifugal. Distinct is centripetal, if you think of a concrete centralized image, right? So he's saying decentralizing and centralized. Diffusely distinct. Then look, that is, if you try to read that as a normal prose reader, it's absurd. He's contradicting himself.
Putting it into literary terms.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense. But if you know he's pointing to a tactile thing that includes both sides all the time, it's perfectly right to say that. Diffusely distinct, sectarian, non-sectarian, religiosity. It's general religiosity. That's a general, another way of saying piety. And they created it. So they made a master move into piety for the electric age, and a religiosity, which it was non-sectarian because it's not in a church, so everybody's hearing it's discarded, it's on the radio, so it's not in any particular religion, and it's sectarian. It's sectarian because it's, what would be the sect? I mean, well, it's Protestant maybe, but it's not that because it's on the radio. And they created, and diffusely distinct. Now, take another way. You have a kind of distinctness. When you get into radio experience, something is diffusely distinct because everybody's listening to it at the same time and projecting their own content.
Right.
You know,
right.
So actually, they are not necessarily, in that phrase, contradictory. Or, you know, to be tactile, you'd say diffusely distinct. But he might, let's put the two words are together on one side, qualifying what it is to be sectarian, not sectarian, when you're on the radio. So again, he is coming up with describing the discarded experience and the consumer's response, which is what McLuhan was all about. See? It's obvious. Okay, and then he goes in, of course, the cow sales, which I remember, you know, what they were, you know, the group for 12-year-olds or something, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, the counselors are the wholesomely, that means young teens, disguised, familiar general religiosity move. Okay, so he's established a category called general religiosity, which is do a sectarian gospel song on the radio. It's automatically generalized because all different kinds of religions are hearing it, right?
Yeah.
So generalized religiosity. So he's saying the counselors are disguised, familiar, so they're disguised birds. For the wholesomeness, move suffused with strong as weak as hell. Yeah, in other words, strong because they're. In other words, he's saying the same thing about the councils that he was trying to say about the birds. They moved in the radio environment, they're doing radio religiosity, and its weakness is a groove, like the Browns' three bells, and the weakness brings in the piety, and it's strong. That's weak as hell, but when it's on the radio, that's good. So it's strong, weak as hell. So actually,
right, it's strong, weak. Yeah.
And so maybe the strong as, he shouldn't say as. It's strong, weak as hell. Maybe the as is justified if he means another meaning than we're getting right now. So that totally makes sense. The cowsills are the wholesome for young kids, disguised, familiar, general religiosity move, suffused with strong as weak as hell religious music, arrangements after the fact, and even some Jan and Dean Lake. So I think we got enough meaning out of that. It makes sense. So he's trying to describe influence. Remember, this is all about vague corporate mixed media, different genres in the radio electric effect. Where is the string of influence? He's showing how there's resonances. It's its influence. He should have said also lots of real resonance by pop Protestant music. Resonance is a more understood word now, rather than
right,
influence, because he didn't mean it. So so that was really good. Now, what? Let's just see. He ends the paragraph by saying, a similar disappointment, huge disappointment. He was depressed for weeks. A similar disappointment is his exclusion. Now, what would, you know what would be part of the disappointment? Which is, this guy got paid to do this erroneous chart, and I could have done better, and they don't even know who I am. You know, so
yeah.
That's really what he's disappointed. The wrong guy's getting attention. A similar disappointment is his exclusion of the Pacific Ocean's effect on surfer music. Okay. A connection which Trini Lopez has claimed to be evident in surf guitar imitations of the rolling of the surf. In terms of influence, he's saying he didn't include the geographical influence for the West Coast sound, you know, the actual natural effect.
Well,
right?
The surf, but the very last part of the surf, yeah, he's not ascribing West Coastness to it.
Yeah, no, he's saying Thompson's West Coast sound, we don't know the details, but left out the effect of the geography. Now, you know why that would be missing? Because actually rock music is all about the effect of cars and living in industry, in the cities. You know, I've cited this before. Barry Miles, in his book on Zappa, he said that for him, Zappa's music, the strange Zappa music, is natural if you understand a life driving around in L.A. with all those highways and the billboards and all that interesting, great L.A. experience. The rhythms of that will come out in the rhythms of Zappa. The rhythms of Zappa echo that. You see what I'm saying?
So
he's pointing out the industrial landscape and the second nature, not first nature, second nature influence on the kind of music that comes out of L.A., the Zappa L.A. sound. And that's why Thompson, I'm winging, just like in this commentary, just like Meltzer.
Right.
I'm making up an instant explanation that Thompson was right to exclude natural effects because they're so puny compared to the industrial effects of the world that people actually live in.
Right, right. That's amazing.
Yeah, so that was a great paragraph. Now, we're probably close. It's getting near 1 o'clock.
Close
to the end.
Yeah.
But I just want to tell our listeners, you're going to get more beautiful explanations of every paragraph because Meltzer evokes all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is amazing. I don't know. I mean, when you're reading this stuff, I have to wonder just how much was he just sort of channeling something that he didn't fully understand, but yet he's intuitive. It's really weird.
You have to understand the crew. He was hanging out with a leading artist, Alan Caprow, and he's at university, and he's having the experience. He's on the leading edge of what youth were experiencing in the 60s, because he's in New York. He gets all the good stuff pretty quickly. And in that mix, that's what he was in an educated environment, so to speak. No, he was in an inspired environment with Alan Caprow.
Right, right.
And he had time, he had the luxury of being stoned and had the time to listen to all this stuff and reading philosophy at the same time. So your question was he channeling? He was channeling the obvious second nature influences all around him in his educational environment.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's at Yale. You might think of an Ivy League as sitting in a classroom, but half of his day is listening to the radio.
Yeah, that's right.
He's at Yale. And, you know, you have transistor radios, you can do that. I mean, if you think of people in the 30s, like McLuhan went to Cambridge, he might hear the radio when he goes back to the home he's boarding at, and they have the radio on down in the living room, he might hear it. But he can't hear it in class, you know what I mean?
Right,
didn't
right.
have transistor radio. But you can take the radio with you into the classroom, as Meltzer probably did.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to just, with that great exegesis, I'm going to read the next paragraph, not go into it, but just see if we can make immediate sense out of it based on what
sure.
we said.
He goes, I think it's a good paragraph, yeah.
Yeah, not so surprisingly, often rock and roll content is itself confusing, if not utterly baffling, to the expert and unaided listener alike. So he's actually continuing to address Thompson, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I totally understand. You should know, if you understand me, how to explain what he's saying there. or, you know, it's correct point, and there's a reason why. In the earlier days of rock, songs like Get a Job by the Silhouettes and Huey, Smith, and the Clowns, Don't You Just Know It. You know, I love reading this stuff because it brings back all the music. You know, I can hear it.
Yeah.
It's a good encyclopedia of great, obscure stuff.
Absolutely.
In the earlier days of rock, songs like Get a Job, oh, by the way, that's what Joyce was doing in Finnegan's Wake. He was trying to throw in everything to evoke all kinds of sensory memories from any medium for the reader.
Right, right.
You know, because he was showing you how you were stimulated by the incredible industrial environment you were living in, which included all this new software radio effect. So, in the earlier days of rock, songs like Get a Job of the Silhouettes and Huey, Smith, and the Clowns, Don't You Just Know It, were virtually impossible to decipher. Well, who cared? They were dancing to it. You know what I mean? Nobody was trying to decipher them. As a matter of fact, you can't decipher Finnegan's Wake on the surface. It's unreadable. And McClone said, that's good, because that's Finnegan's Wake miming how people were responding to the lyrics in rock and roll. It was more precise in the 50s, because it was still literary, but by the 60s, you couldn't hear half of it. And you might, if you're tuned in, stoned, you might hear it, figure it out. But it wasn't important to decipher just the verbal meaning.
Right. Well, and that, isn't he just saying that he's just merely describing. I mean, that was the effect it had. Like,
he's
I don't
describing
think
the effects. He's not giving the causes. I'm giving the causes.
Right, right. But I don't think he's putting any slant on that at all.
Well, what do you mean?
I don't know.
No, he's making a point. Let's see what the point is in this paragraph.
Okay.
He's putting a slant on it.
Okay.
During the same period appeared the coaster Searchin', replete with references to Sergeant Friday, Sam Spade, and Boston Blackie. Particularly enigmatic, although more easily deciphered. One strange metaphor is found in, quote, I'm going to walk right down that street like Bulldog Drummond, end of quote. A song known as Around and Around, something like that. You didn't get time to look it up, right?
Yeah.
Some book, Finnegan's Fluke or something, some book like that by Joyce, okay?
Yeah.
a song known as Around and Around, something like that, was mysteriously just that, a dizzying repetition of that single phrase. Now, it's a literary approach. He's in college, he's reading, he's getting literary, and he wants to decipher stuff. Nobody's worried about the dizzying repetition of the thing when they're dancing to it, right? He's ridiculous even making these issues, but he's writing a book, so that's what you do when you're a book, right? You get concerned about these big disappointments. I can't decipher the lyrics. More recently, the Beach Boys' Help Me Rhonda has proven itself a decoding problem. What D. Gerber found it to say was, quote, since she put me down, I do it in my PID. It's like a Finnegan's Wake sentence.
Yeah.
Then he says, the last word of which I later admitted to head or bed, just as meaningless. The Beatles' Night Before refers to several different periods of time with little coherency and consistency of any. It may be merely an uninterpreted deductive system, but the rhetoric of the rock song is predominant and logic isn't even allowed to be clear enough to be confusing. And in the name game, Shirley Ellis presents confusion plus deep complexity, heightening that which accompanies the learning of any new game by sticking the instructions in the song that can't be slowly examined or immediately reread. See, it's happening too fast.
Yeah.
If he can't reread it. Okay, so that's lots of stuff. We can go into that next time.
More, that's good.
It's very good. He's providing great fodder for our classroom.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's very true, yeah.
I am finished. I am, as Ian would say, I am incomplete.
Okay. Okay, that sounds good, Bob. So,
okay.
We're back on track with some Meltzer stuff, and we'll forge ahead with that.
This will be fun forever. We can do this for many years.
Yeah, well, I think this is a good approach, definitely.
Yeah, we work with Scripture. We work with Scripture, Meltzer, the Old Testament of Meltzer.
Yeah.
And we create a New Testament out of this.
That's right.
Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks, Scott.
Sounds good, Bob. Talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.